You're listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities through story. From Darwin, Australia, this is your host, Lucy Van Sambeek. So here I am sitting in beautiful Marlow Lagoon, just out of Palmerston in the Northern Territory, for my third episode of Talk the Walk. And my guest today is Josephine Lee. She's a Gadjalla woman from Northern Queensland who graduated with a Bachelor of Social Work in 1991 from James Cook, so she's been around a while. And in 2004, she went off to the Indigenous Leadership Centre in Canberra to earn a Diploma of Indigenous Leadership. Jo has pretty much done it all in her career, a wide range of counselling work, casework, group work and community development in many different settings, from youth work, domestic violence, juvenile justice, legal, health, education and child protection. I'm not sure that leaves much. Jo has also served as a director of the ASW board since 2013. She describes her practice as anti-oppressive, anti-racist, therapeutic and relationship-based practices, as well as creative and hope-focused practices. Jo is currently employed as the senior school counsellor with the Department of Education in the NT. Wow, that's an amazing record there, Jo. Thank you for joining me.
Hi, Lucy. Absolute privilege to have this opportunity to share some stories with you.
Great, thank you. I've been really looking forward to our conversation. And I'd like to acknowledge the caretakers of this place. It's absolutely beautiful, the Larrakia people. What do you know about the history of this place? Do you know much about the area here?
No, Lucy, and I'm quite guilty, like many people who come to Darwin fall in love with it and remain in love but don't do the more proactive process of actually checking out deeper. And talking about being in love, I fell in love with the Larrakian man and I'm married to him. And very, very lucky that many times being forced at NAIDOC time to do barbecues at Marlowe's Lagoon and somehow... Jason and I ending up doing the barbecue for hours on end. So I say that both positively as well as, you know, where you wonder why you're the one doing it all the time. But anyway, I feel very privileged and fortunate to be meeting here today.
Yeah, beautiful. So I'm really interested, when I was reading through your bio, I was really interested in the way you described this hope-focused practices. And I'm wondering what that's about. It's the first time I've kind of heard that term. Could you... explore that a bit.
So I can't claim that it's my term, but what I can claim, it's something that I'm thinking about and hopefully it evolves over time as I learn from the practice that I do every day. So I want to be really clear, there's a number of concepts that describe hope-focused work across the planet. Mm. Where I'm coming from is the concept being quite aware of two things. The positive that social work can be a vehicle for change, but the other side of it is really being aware that social work is a very white middle class profession. Mm. And the risk with that is professionals colluding with hopelessness or helplessness when they're working with minority groups, and particularly Aboriginal people in Australia, where I see almost daily professionals colluding with a story because it actually benefits them for that story to continue. And my challenge is, if you come from a hope-focused position, you will always be hopeful that there will be a change of magnificent change, I'm talking about, where people are truly allowed to be able to reflect their true worth in the, and their dignity at their greatest, which means the risk is that social work would be eroded and at risk of not existing. What a wonderful story.
Mm.
I'm going to be really frank about that. So that might come through, Lucy, that I have both a high regard for social work, but at the same time, I also diss it, you know, and which might sound disrespectful, but I'm going to say it's coming from a position of don't become comfortable in your comfortability.
Yes.
Because otherwise you become a parasite of living off other people's misery. That does not sit well with me. My moral compass just went through the roof just then, hearing myself. And so that's the other thing that probably where hope focus really comes from deep within myself. And Christine Fijo King is another Aboriginal social worker who articulates it really well in a lot of her writings, is your moral compass. Because one of the things about colonisation, there wasn't a moral compass operating in amongst all of that. Okay? And what people, when you have colonisers or the mainstream or the dominant voice, often it erodes what is fundamental as a human being, what is morally right. So what is your mores, I'm talking your M-O-R-E-S, and your laws, L-O-R-E-S. Because when they become eroded, you are then eroding anchors for what guides you in life. And so if you have social work taking too much pride in its ego of its part it plays, that is not good. Because you should be striving for a position of where the disempowered becomes so empowered that you no longer really need to shine.
Yes.
Because they're shining.
Yes. So it's this idea of working ourselves out of a job, like you were referring to earlier.
Yeah. And so that is also a challenge for me personally, because, you know, we all get trapped in the capitalist consumer world and whatever. And so one of the challenges for me is to really look at the community development approach, where, okay, if the way we exist is in this capitalist world, then you've got to work with it to really improve people's situation.
So how might hope-focused work differ from strengths-based work, which, you know, has a very big presence, you know, in universities, and we're taught about strengths-based practice, and lots of people can verbalise, talk the rhetoric of it. And, yeah, I'm wondering how does it differ from, because many social workers would be familiar with strengths-based practice.
Yeah.
How would it play out differently?
So I'm going to come from a couple of positions there. I'm very fortunate to say Wayne McCashin's one of my good friends, so who is one of the big writers and thinkers around strengths-based approach. But I think Wayne would also be quite forgiving of me of what I'm going to say now, in that what I've witnessed, so it's purely my what I've observed in practice, and in particularly in the child protection space. So they'll talk about that they have taken on board strengths-based approach, but how it's actually interpreted and translated and changed from, you know, what you would hope would be a deeper understanding of Aboriginal people's lives, and I'll explain a little bit more what I mean by that, to doing whatever you can in your practice that will enhance further what is going well in people's lives, okay?
Yes.
Now, one of the difficulties with child protection, just by the nature of it, is deficit-focused, okay? And there's parts of child protection that has to be deficit-focused, particularly at the acute end of child abuse, okay, which is the smallest percentage of what presents. But as for the majority, most of it's related to being disadvantaged or poor. Our society needs to do a really major overhaul around how it generally helps those who has less than them. To contextualise, particularly how I'm arriving at different concepts and theories and approaches, and eventually, you know, How do I articulate some of the practice wisdom that I've carry and is growing?
Yes.
And I think it's really important. I'll actually take you back to understand, because it's not just understanding me, it's understanding a large percentage of Aboriginal people's experience of Australian society, as well as social work's part in Aboriginal people's lives, and also for your learning as a non-Indigenous people in this space.
Mm.
So this year is the 50th year of the referendum. So I'm a perfect example of a child who was born before Aboriginal people were given the vote. So I was actually born at a time that, number one, the Aboriginal Protection Act was still active.
Mm.
So I was a child that wasn't allowed to be in white society. So there was child protection reports done on me, which is under the Aboriginal Protection Act.
Right.
Of Aboriginal woman with white man, and we've got to find that child because that child should not exist, right?
Yes.
The second thing is that child shouldn't exist because how do you classify a coloured human being when they shouldn't be in white society, and where do they fit in Aboriginal society? So if you think about how people entered that space of eugenics and then actively did the white Australian policy and stolen generations and all that sort of stuff.
Mm.
So I'm a person who represents that era in particular. So born to an Aboriginal mother and a white father, and also in a town, Charters Towers, North Queensland, where they were the lowest voters for the right for Aboriginal people to vote.
Oh, okay.
So it'll give you an idea of the level of racism in that area, okay, where they truly did not believe Aboriginal people should be counted as a citizen, as well as have the capacity, as every other human being, to contribute to society. So born into that space, as well as born to two different human beings, not only gender-wise, race-wise, culture, blah, blah, blah. So having to learn to walk in two worlds, and where one part of the world doesn't actually accept you, because I also was born into an era where they did classifications of people, of half-caste, quarter-caste, etc. The most dehumanising process that goes on is to compare you similar to animals. So it also laid the foundations of where, for me, that from a very young age, I saw in society the serious social justice issues and the way one group of people treated another group of people, and how do you make sense of that where it wasn't even allowed for animals. Also, with my parents having two very different personalities. My father, a white father, highly abusive, cruel human being. And my mother, the absolute opposite, a very gentle, kind human being, but was trapped in a highly abusive marriage, etc. So also there's a combination of a number of things that makes the ingredients for the social justice cake has grown.
I love that. Social justice cake. Is that the way you describe your practice framework?
Well, that actually might be a good way, and what it actually really means, not just one line in ethics, social work ethics. What I'm going to say to you next, Liz, is going to surprise you, I think, but it will be a story that I think is magnificent. I have no shame in my life now, because there comes a point where you realise there are things that weren't your responsibility, and there are things that you did damn try hard to change in life, sort of thing. So giving you an idea of what I was born into, and then growing up in a highly probably no one would agree with you that grew up around us, probably one of the most violent childhoods you could imagine. And so I won't say too much about that, but it will give you indicate why I have the capacity to have incredible courage in certain situations where I probably can relate similarly to other people, where you've had to be brave no matter how scared shitless you are. And that when and bravery, particularly when it comes to truth and what is right, okay, when you've been exposed to life and death threats, etc., nothing else actually can ever frighten you, because there's nothing to lose. You have more to lose when you don't act on your moral compass. And I'm going to say how social work came into my life.
Great. I don't have to ask the questions. No. Just keep going the storytelling way.
So up until I was about 15, and there will be school teachers who can actually confirm this as well, where I was definite about becoming a vet, had no qualms or hesitation that I had the ability about being able to do that, because teachers would actually try to persuade me to think about becoming a doctor. And I was a very old child. So some of the things that would come out of my mouth, even teachers can tell you, were like old woman. And I would say, well, why become a doctor when I actually don't like humans enough? The way humans treat each other and that, I'm not happy with. So I was saying things like that even as young as 5 years of age. But there are things that happen in life or are forced on into you on in life that push you to have growth and seriously look at what path you're going to take. People might say it was tragic that I had witnessed and experienced some pretty full-on things in my teenage years. But I'm also fortunate I learnt from those things is about the path I was going to take in life. And so I didn't know social workers existed until one visited me.
Right.
And I'd ran away from home and I'd gone from the bloody frying pan into the fire, right? Went from one dreadful situation to another dreadful situation. And this dreadful situation involved that I'd witnessed children being abused by adults in a sexual way. Fortunately, I wasn't in that situation myself, but witnessed and realised, okay, I don't like humans. Well, someone's going to have to do something serious about what's going on. So a social worker comes along and visits me, and I never see that social worker again. And I'm thinking, and I apologise, Lucy, this is the conversation a 16-year-old has with herself. Well, that was the most fucking hopeless human being I've ever come across. Because she did not see the seriousness of the situation of a child who was actually growing themselves up. But this is probably going to flabbergast you now, Lucy, is that, and I'll come to it later, is I actually have those records now from Child Protection of... what was assessed, et cetera, et cetera.
And what was written down
exactly.
And recorded.
Now, it's firmed up that that was a useless social worker, okay?
A hopeless social worker.
Leading to hopeless social worker. Exactly. Because I can see how people collude with the hopeless story or have low expectations, or if they can't do anything, so nothing can be done. Well, that's not true. What is going to surprise you next is the magnificent story. So later in my 16th year, Child Protection did get involved with my family quite seriously and quite importantly. Then I was exposed to social workers full on, children's homes, and all the other things that go with the removal of children from a violent household. But also, I also witnessed the toing of frying during that period of people arguing around who can care for these children.
Right.
But it all happened in now, what seemed like a long time then, it's a short time. Mm. And it happened quite quickly where I'm actually the oldest of 9 siblings, and I won't get into details out of respect for them, but all of those siblings ended up living with me over their childhood and adult life. But what I can say is at age 17, this is the magnificent part of the story, which also fits in with the rest of what I'm going to say to you. Child protection, the particular caseworker at the time, who was actually quite a lovely human being, she had approached me about taking on half of my siblings to care of them.
And how old were you at this time? 16 still?
No, 17.
17, yeah.
And I know there are a lot of people at the time and onwards who thought I was too young and what a big thing, but also what an unfair thing, etc.
Mm.
But when you hear the rest of my life from them, you'll realise there are things in life that are put out to you for a reason. And mm-hmm. they explain that.
Mm.
Because it's also connected with being hope-focused. And one is responsibility. It's a really big thing that I believe in. And it's one of the clashes between Western society and Indigenous society, is this issue of responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll do the best I can to explain that whole way of thinking. Life, for every human being, allows you opportunities to step up and be responsible, right? There's a lovely way of putting it also, that many opportunities in life gives you permission to be brave.
Mm.
Okay. And tragedy is one of those things, that triumph and much beauty can come out of tragedy.
Mm.
And that's one of the biggest lessons that life has given me, particularly reaching 50 and realising, oh my God, there's much more to come. So at 17, I took on the care of half of my siblings, who were highly traumatised children, and I was a highly traumatised child. But what would be arguably the strength, when you want to include strengths-based approach, is the level of responsibility that I and my siblings continue to demonstrate as to how we approach life. And it's a very much an Indigenous view. So we look around now, Lucy, right, around us. The world tells us we are responsible for it,
mm.
right?
Mm.
Every grass, everything,
mm.
you and I are responsible for it.
Mm.
But that's where humans have gotten lost, is that they've gotten caught up with greed and the take syndrome. Because when you are responsible, you know it is both give and take.
Mm.
And the more you give, the more you actually receive. That doesn't necessarily mean you have taken, it just comes back to you. So whatever you can say, whether it be child protection or pretty broad-minded social worker, or all the right ingredients came together, where this is many examples of social justice in action,
mm.
okay?
Mm-hmm.
Social justice does not mean that some social worker has done this and this thing and then gets a medal for where the social worker. No, it's about people who've risen above this, their circumstances. In India, for example, they have a beautiful story about the lotus flower. It's the perfect way of describing how for human beings, particularly with trauma backgrounds, can incredible beauty can grow from the muddiest, dirty of water. That's one of my hopes for social work, is them understanding that the majority of human beings, not only is there that strength, is beauty there in every human mm. being, you mm. know, and sometimes people can be blind to that, and that's part of being hope focused, you helping them to see again what it is that they have, you know? And responsibility, everyone has that, whether you're in a wheelchair or you're a baby or you're old and whatever. And as you get older, obviously you have greater responsibility, and that includes the sharing of wisdom and helping people to maybe do less of the mistakes that you have made, you know, sort of thing. I'm very fortunate at a young age to have really understood what responsibility means, and particularly as an Indigenous person, but also as a woman, and also where probably more than ever the planet needs responsible human beings to step up. And when we're in a hopeless state, we're actually at risk of, we don't want to be responsible. And when we're in states of despair, which we know a lot of is happening in Aboriginal communities, that is about when the soul is struggling to have peace. But one of the things that I know is really powerful for people to overcome trauma and hopelessness and helplessness is to have a sense of responsibility, your purpose, your part on this planet. And for Aboriginal people, if you keep them in a definition of client, you rob them of being a human being, okay? You actually rob yourself as a social worker from a deeper connection and a deeper interaction and a deeper path that we're all required to share on this planet. And so there's some of the challenges also around what is perceived professional boundaries, what is authentic relationships,
I've experienced those challenges.
Accused
of getting too close to people, too close to communities.
And so are we asking human beings to connect, or are we asking robots to deliver a bureaucracy or whatever? So getting back to that point of what I'm really stressing about responsibility and what it means to me. In probably using my own family as a really powerful point. And I want to show you, Lucy, because this will sort of makes it more profound. This is my mother, and this is me, you know, as the oldest of a whole lot of children. This is my mum, this is my nana, this is me and one of my sisters.
Yes.
This is my nana here. She's the youngest of 17 children, right?
Wow.
What I want to explain, it's only in my generation that removal happened, right? We don't have a history of stolen generation. We don't have people who've disappeared because they knew where they were moved, right? Okay, there's a difference. And so also what I see is what has also happened with the ongoing impact of colonization and erosion of culture, and erosion of people's rights and their connection to country, etc.
It's
also where you look at the impact of child protection and removals. You can also see as the path of colonization continuing to impact on a people. I hope that made sense to you. And so
definitely. Oh, we see it.
Exactly.
All around us.
So, you know, even so fortunately for most of my brothers and sisters, they have a sense of, intervention had to occur around a dangerous situation, but there was a social worker who thought pretty out of the square about how do we keep family members to get together, that if you further remove them and further break them up, that you're actually going to cause even further harm and trauma.
So your experience was that you and your siblings stayed together?
But that's, it's like, it's not a perfect story, but what can be said is, so for example, for myself, there are people who would have argued that I could have went into care. I'm going to say something to you. I am so glad I'm a human being who did not go into care. I would see that I would have ended up a more broken human being. That is one of the tragedies.
The thing that I'm thinking of right now is, how did we get to this situation now where the number of removals is going up? There are more Aboriginal children in care than have ever been. How did we get to this point, given that back in, you know, the story you've just shared, someone had the inclination, a very good social worker, thankfully, kept you together. And, yeah, so where have we gone so wrong over the last 20, 30 years?
I think it's in many things, Lucy.
Because that social worker saw hope.
Exactly. Exactly.
In keeping you together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And didn't come from some idealistic model that, particularly an institutionalised type of view, where we had a lot invested in children's homes and perfectly clean, orderly spaces were perceived as that's what children are going to thrive in, but we know they were just spaces of harshness and cruelty and control sort of thing. It's not about love and whatever. I'll tell you another little story to give you an example, and it became a lot clearer for me. I was very fortunate. I got the opportunity when I was 30 to go to Germany and work at the end of the Bosnian-Herzegovinian war with refugees. And I wanted to do that experience for many reasons, and knowing that I would gain incredible personal and professional growth. But it was also a challenge for me around me, who had spent a large part of my life as the youngest, before I even started school, as being a parentified child, if you use Western language, or an overly responsible human being. Well, they all infer a negative rather than an exceptional human being, where there are those of us who have a great and deep understanding of our responsibility.
Yes.
And I'll get back to the story of when I was in Germany. I was very fortunate to meet many different types of people who've overcome incredible trauma, etc., but also different points of views. And one was a social worker who'd had cancer. He was told he was going to die, and as with those near-death experiences, they confront you to really sort out what's important in life, And he was able to share with me a lot of things that became clear to him, and one was he loved this artist who did natural sculptures, and then the sculptures would be knocked down to go back to how they should be.
Right.
But at the time, he'd do not natural sculpture and then give a title for what it's meant to depict. And this particular photo, Lucy, where the artist has placed different rocks, and it represents family, community, life. And I want to explain. When culture and community is at its healthiest, there are things that life that happens, no matter what, knocks you about, the waves, the storms and whatever. Do you manage to hang in there, or your balance and whatever? It's when things become out of balance that this will fall apart and things will change into a destructive way and that. And some people are probably using the term resilience a lot these days to explain things. One of the things I am concerned about is when social workers grasp hold of the latest trendy thing of trauma-informed or resiliency. I want to argue something. They're fantastic concepts.
Yes.
But Aboriginal people are the most bloody resilient human beings on the planet, right? The fact that they choose to continue to be hopeful is an absolute, an amazing thing about their spirit. We also have to understand when the soul gets tired of being hurt and chooses to opt out, you know?
Right.
It's tragic, but we have to understand what is going on, because we're concerned that it will feed racism. And we have a racist society in Australia, whether people like to hear that or not. It will collude with a terrible story that goes on that Aboriginal people are struggling with their lives because they're Aboriginal. Right? That there's something bad about being Aboriginal. Okay? That's not why they're ending their lives or they're drinking themselves to death. It's about the level of social justice inequities in our society and the messages you are given along the way in your journey as to where you fit and as to your value and whether you're worthless or you're of some worth. Okay? Yes. It also in our society doesn't acknowledge the different ways of living that are necessary for the planet's existence. Because the wage slave mortgage to your die existence does not help the planet.
No.
It is the most self-centered human behaviour that is going on the planet. You know, I'm in that trap as well. But if we don't be critical of what we are actually doing, we do not allow for those ways of living that have been around for millions of years that are far, far more kinder for the planet, are far, far more kinder for us as human beings and our existence.
Nature has so much to teach us, doesn't it, on ways of living?
Exactly.
Looking at your picture.
Exactly. And animals are an incredible guide as well, you know. So, for example, and you're going to laugh at this, Lucy, I have two dogs, and I will always have dogs because they're like little spirit friends with me. When I get tired of the humans, I go and tell them my frustrations, and then they tell me, just let it go. So Chi-Chi catches me on the mobile the other day, and I'm flicking through Facebook, blah, blah, blah. Chi-Chi tells me she's had enough of me ignoring her and pay her attention, right?
Yes.
And I had a moment of thinking, how must this be for a child with a parent? How much must that go on where us selfish adults get consumed with our self-importance, et cetera, et cetera, and we ignore those around us that we care about, let alone the level of ignorance that's going on about what we're doing to the planet. And so that leads me back to those two concepts of hopefulness and responsibility, because I hear too often, and it can be particularly from white middle-class social workers, well, it's too hard to do something. So they're actually become hopeless. And also helpless.
So do you mean in reference to things like technology and how that is taking over and affecting people's lives, and that's something that's out of our control in that situation, or you...
Just, actually, that's a good point, Lucy, around clarification. It's in general.
Yep.
Whether it be, Aboriginal people's plight is too great, right? Well, that's an incredibly... coming from a position of privilege and comfortability to say that. And I'll be honest with most Aboriginal people would like to say, well, fuck off. Stop bothering us and fuck off. You're useless. We need a human being who's actually going to be useful and hopeful.
Yes.
Okay. And it is an absolute truth that every human being not only has responsibility, has the capacity to influence change in a good way, okay? And I'll explain. Lucy, like what you're doing today, I hope it starts to not only influence you, but influence other social workers who are not Aboriginal to start seriously look at the authentic relationships that they enter into with Aboriginal people, okay? Because if they're frightened of them or whatever, I would ask, please choose another social work field or choose something else.
Yes.
Because I wanted to explain to you, Aboriginal people are incredibly attuned to reading other people. The more traumatised you are, you can read other people. Whether you like it or not, you're not that damn good at having masks on that will say you're out of your depth. Where a lot of Aboriginal people, which is the most loveliest saying, will say, poor thing, she need to go back home. Which I see is very compassionate, generous and forgiving, right? And because you think about Aboriginal people, that white people use the term tolerant, which is actually, someone brought to my attention, it's actually an ugly word.
We tolerate?
Yeah, it means that
white fella's coming in.
Sort of thing. But I think Aboriginal people have actually been incredibly generous with visitors or people coming in to have incredible power in their lives.
Mm.
And you know, think about it. They're waiting and waiting for something better to happen.
So they never lose hope.
Yeah,
No matter how many times we stuff things up and don't go in with respect and,
And I also ask that social workers seriously consider, and I'm really simplifying this, you're really investing a lot in the signposts that go like this. Well, Aboriginal people's stories are the mad, bad, sad story. Well, hold on, what about the glad story? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
What part do you play as a human being, let alone if your profession happens to be social work, psychology or community development, but as a human being as to genuinely making this world a better place for all? And I'm fortunate. I don't need God or Jesus Christ or Allah or any other thing out there symbolic to tell me there are things in the on that happen on the planet that are right and wrong, right?
The law of nature.
Exactly. And so, for example, to put it crassly, animals know how to do humanity better than humans. And so us humans have gotten so caught up with, infatuated with our cleverness that it's no longer clever. It's bordering on stupidity, Lucy.
Okay. Well, we can see the results of that. We've stuffed up this planet, to put it mildly.
But because I do operate from a hopeful position, and I actually believe that there will be many more chapters and that the world will actually not only return to a way of existence because we have to, but because most humans will want that. Yeah, I think that path is actually growing strongly.
I was just looking back at some of the notes I've been taking as you've been talking, and I've got big square boxes around courage, responsibility and social justice in action. And I'm wondering if there are other values or principles that you put into your social justice cake, the thing that guides you in your work and in your life, that we haven't talked about yet.
Years ago, when I was a family and relationship counsellor, I had incredible learnings during that period in my life. Not only having to learn how to operate in a white middle class environment, etc., really stretching myself, and being able to have intimate conversations with people of different backgrounds, whether it be my colleagues or and most importantly, the clients, that somehow whatever I did was incredibly good for them at the time. In small or big ways, and I still have a picture, which is to actually prompt me a little bit about in answering your question around the other things that I draw on that. You don't know me really well, Lucy, but as you will get to know me, you'll discover that I can't not say the truth, even if it's brutal and that. But also, as you get to know me, you'll know that I'm a kind person. And kind, what people got to understand, kind people aren't foolish people. They deliberately choose to want to impact on people's lives in a gentle way, and to influence it But there are times where I know I've been a bit brutal, but it still was the intent to be gentle to people. And so this particular photo, picture is just from a magazine picture that a client cut out. Because I asked her when she repeatedly was cutting her arms, which was self-harming, and for some people freaking them out that she was going to end up ending her life. It's good to share this story in particular, and it fits with many other stories with my work with clients or people when they have been in a period in their life and they're feeling vulnerable and they've reached out for help. And probably my best moment, because often it is a moment of my work with people, and it's how I've approached the way of helping them to look at whatever it is that they're struggling with or challenged by. And so that's the other thing to emphasise for social work, is how do you do the theory, but how do you do the whole head, heart and soul approach as well, okay? Because it's not one or the other. Otherwise you become a stilted human living sort of thing. So this young person, she was self-cutting, you know, her wrists and that. And, you know, over a period of time, it looked rather impressive, you know, all the amount of cuts, etc. It was freaking people out that she might end her life. And I had to make a judgment, well, you know, she gets psychiatric assessment, but that's not the only help she needs. She's entered a conversation, a challenge to work out something. And at the time she presented, she said she didn't know what it was, but if we reflect back on it, what she was asking was is to have more peace in her life because she was being tortured, you know, and I'll explain a bit more of that. So her father had sexually abused her. Her father was very well respected in the community, so she was torn between knowing her father was a loved human being, but also her father had done something to her that shouldn't have happened. And so that process that many victims of child sexual abuse go through of making sense of someone who you love and cared for has done something that could be in the classification of evil and that, and trying to work through that. And also that issue of if your body has betrayed you as well. And so particularly with adolescence, you struggle with your body, the growth, etc., and perceptions, but then to have on that layer of complexity when there's been sexual abuse, etc., and particularly by certain members in the family. There's greater complexity of sexual abuse with family members than there is with non-family members.
Right.
Because of the interpersonal level of there is an existing relationship.
Right.
So I did not see myself at that time being able to fix things. And also the challenge around, was it necessary for me to be part of fixing something?
Lots of social workers think that way, don't they?
Yeah.
They have to go in and fix things.
Yeah, which is also a challenge for me to try and learn and over many situations, right? And what this young person gave me is wonderful learnings around being able to walk alongside someone during a very painful process of self-discovery.
Yes.
Okay? Of defining yourself as to what it is you want to be. And I'll explain a bit more of that. One of the sad things for many Aboriginal people is defining yourself in the negative, okay? And social work and psychology and other mainstream professions collude with that, okay?
It's a very deficit-focused way of thinking, isn't it?
Yeah. So that whole welfare dependency colludes with that thing of making you lesser than. you know, and justify someone else's involvement in your life in a paternalistic way. Also, what I learned from this young person is around the varying ways in which hurting can look like, mm-hmm. and the continuing of self-harm. And trust that I made sure that she did go and get psychiatric assessment, because that is also the safety net around if she is going to end her life. It, for yourself, you know that you got someone else to also check.
Mm.
What I also learnt from that situation is to really tune into the person. And this is where the creative side of it is.
Okay.
Tuning into what is it that they will find will help express whatever it is that they're struggling with.
Mm-hmm.
So whether it be art, as in visual arts, music, as in singing, or other ways in which you're able to tell a story or enter a space of going from harm to healing.
Yeah.
That maybe not just, you know, the clinical way is going to necessarily be rich enough for a person, for deep nourishment and flourishment to happen, okay? Because you've got to have nourishment to come in so that flourishment to go out, if that makes sense.
So is your understanding of the self-harm that that was her way of expressing the pain? And
Exactly.
So you're trying to explore with her what are possible other ways of expressing that pain?
Exactly.
Right.
And so eventually her... So I was actually also having to be part of a journey of her identity evolving.
Yep.
Okay.
Mm.
So going from being victim to being survivor.
Mm.
Okay. And also that your story is not, so narrative therapy is, I believe, one of the most powerful ways of working, of restoring, and also how people can mirror back to themselves what it is that they want to be, you know.
Mm.
And so for this young woman, I asked her, can you go and look out there? And I'm not going to tell you how it's going to look or what it's going to look like. What do you think a spirit that is less tortured looks like? I deliberately chose not to say the happy spirit, but a spirit that is less tortured. Okay? Right? Because life is not without things that hurt. That's actually part of the deal. That's part of the whole deal. It's how you learn from that hurt and that.
Okay. When people talk about a healing process, sometimes I wonder, is that an end point? But I don't think the healing journey is an end point. It's ongoing. And so you always can carry that pain in some way.
Exactly.
But it's a lesser of a pain.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so she found this picture. And I asked her to talk to the picture. And so this is what she described to me. I see this young woman dancing in the forest and she's free. And I say to her, why do you think she's free? Because she's uninhibited. There's a smile that comes easily. She's not constrained. She's not tied down. She's not burdened with sorrow. And I say, you can see all that in that picture. Is that actually you seeing it? She goes, yes, it's me. And I said, well, that's what you've made, not anyone else. This is what you've manufactured, you've realised. Okay? So that's one of many stories for me where I learnt how do you go with someone on their journey and try to not dominate it with you or what it is that you feel you have to fix. Okay. Because when you create, one of the risks is you can create dependency, or the person still extending to that something else
yes.
is what only makes me exist, when
right.
in actual fact you make yourself exist.
Yes.
Okay.
So I guess language and the way you use language with people is very important. And
exactly.
the questions you are asking her very much.
Exactly. Exactly.
Gave her ownership over
exactly.
the process.
Exactly.
Mm.
Because when you're also dealing with people when they're very, quite vulnerable, they're not in their most wholest self. And so the risk is that you can cause further harm or meddling that is about you, not about them.
Mm.
You know?
Mm.
So, and I come, I also realise that, and I'll explain that even more so as connected with my early life. So I discovered as a child, which I stressed to you about learning about bravery and courage and that, but also comes with those attributes is realizing the strength and power that you do have.
Mm.
Okay? And that's one of the things about strength-based approach, that if people really tuned into the importance of understanding the power that you have and how you best use that to empower others.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very fine tune though in doing that. And I have to be always mindful of this myself, is how much I use my power to truly lift others. Or am I dominating others with my thinking and what it is that I believe? Even though I think it's right, you've got to make sure people reach their vision and mission in life that is true to them, because otherwise they will still not be whole people. They're hanging off others' frames of reference.
That's a very skillful thing to be able to do, isn't it?
Yeah.
Go on a healing journey with someone but not be the person that they're relying on to do that
yeah.
with. Yeah.
Yeah. So there were many experiences, both positive and negative, because often when we say some experiences in life were negative, they're often the ones that the greatest growth can happen from. And that's where being reflective is really important.
Mm.
And social work has grasped onto a wonderful way of being and doing in social work. It can truly be reflective.
Mm.
And reflective doesn't mean you do a wanky exercise of, well, how did I do today? Well, I did fantastic. That's not reflective. You've got to actually be a bit deeper in critical.
Mm.
And that doesn't mean that you... a sadomasochist that you start whipping yourself off as well, is that questioning yourself every time you're with people. And when you become really practiced at it, it happens very quickly, you know. Or it could be later where you pull yourself up and you say, I could have done that better, you know. Or, Jesus, I did that well. I've got a capture as to how that evolved. So from the day dot of my life was a sense of, that I had a sense around social justice issues anyway.
Yes.
As to how others treated others, etc. And also looking at those situations of when witnessing people being hurt and whatever, and saying to myself that I hope I can do things differently. And stuff, and be a different type of person. And so witnessing people who've caused so much harm and left so many hurt people, and learn from that, well, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to leave this planet with a lot of hurt. I'm going to leave this planet with healing, sort of thing. So very fortunate as a young child that I had also been exposed to probably exceptional situations or unusual situations. So that also make you who you are. So you think about it, sent off to boarding school at age 5, and I'm the only age 5-year-old at the boarding school. So one gets a lot of attention and sport rotten from a whole lot of childless middle-aged women in boarding schools, and all these kids who had a plaything, blah, blah, blah. And I actually understand a little bit of what the Chinese emperor child felt like for a period in my life, sort of thing. But also, yeah, that overindulged to later in my life experiencing the opposite of becoming invisible in poverty and that. So having experiences early in my life that really challenge you and give you great opportunities to grow and learn from and that.
So was this where you were starting to get ideas about power and empowerment?
Had no doubt. I jokingly say that the feminist gods gathered up there in the heavens to make sure I was made and spat out. But interestingly, it's not just feminists, it's around black empowerment theory.
Mm-hmm.
Barbara Solomon is an African-American social worker who wrote this wonderful text called Black Empowerment. And for me, it became a greater theory than feminist theory.
Right.
Okay? Mm. Because it also helped me to make sense of what I worked out pretty early in life, that social workers really careful because it's a very privileged profession.
Yes.
And when I hear social workers claim they're not paid well and I discover how high their salary is and particularly how much it is compared with the people they serve and the income that they get, I hear privilege cry. I don't hear something deeper sort of thing. So I apologise to those social workers who might get a bad deal, but the majority of you, I'm sorry, you're on a bloody good deal. So there are things that I've learnt from in my life that have forced me to seriously look at my part, again, my responsibility as to what I'm going to do about it. But the other thing that I've also learnt from is the feedback. So I'm a very privileged practitioner who's been given many, many feedback from the people that I've had to help in life. And I'll give you examples. So I've also been a foster carer, you know, beyond my being a carer for my siblings. And when case managers wouldn't assist with children being able to meet with their families, I would force it to happen and make it happen. And so there are many families who have contacted me later and have been grateful to me for allowing them to be able to have meaningful contact with their family and lives. It's actually not really hard to do decent things at times. But anyway, the second thing is, because I've had such a powerful role in my own family's life, so many of them have given feedback to me. Most of my siblings, I can't say all of them, because there are some who still struggle in life, and that doesn't mean that they're weaker or lesser than, that there's some things that they have yet to work through and that. But the majority of my siblings, I can say quite proudly, and I know, and they've told me, it's because of my influence, is they've chosen lives without violence in their life, okay? But they've also made really tough decisions like me, and for some people they might see it as hard, but it's decisions that we could live with. And some of us have chosen to not have children because in our family was a rotten tree, and that rotten tree was our father. And for some of us, we don't want any more production of that rotten tree, which means for our own lives that we've chosen that there will never be the possibility of further harm ever happening. So for some, it's hard for them to understand. Like one woman, the child protection worker who I got my records of, said, "But you would have been the most amazing mother because you gave your siblings more opportunities than the average family had given them," and that. And I said, "Okay, I'm going to say something that might sound a bit like a feminist. We're all put on this earth, and for some of us, we're put here for a reason, to make it a better place. And you actually have to do that with making it clear You have to have all your energy and all that you have because it's going to be needed, okay?
Mm.
And if you had children, the world's going to miss out on what it is that you're going to do to help it, okay?
Mm.
So there's some of us, my siblings, who are similar to me, who are doing wonderful things to care for others and the planet without having produced children.
Mm.
Okay. Mm. Way, way, way back in Mexico, which people forget, they had many, many indigenous groups and cultures, right? And when the Spaniards invaded, they caused incredible destruction.
Mm.
There are many indigenous groups from that time that no longer exist, right? Mm. And some are from the huge rapes and murders, children abused, disease, the white man's poison of alcohol, blah, 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 right? There's also were tribes who actually chose self-extinction, right?
Right.
And one tribe chose self-extinction. And this, because they were such a deeply spiritual tribe, and the way they saw it is that what is going on with the planet right now, the Spaniards, the destruction of our culture, the taking of our women and children, and all that is going on, eroding, is wrong.
Mm.
They chose to no longer breed, right?
Mm.
Because then no longer their children could be taken because there's no children to take.
Right.
They chose to die out, okay? Now, one might think that's a sad story, but there's beauty to that story. Because they were such a deeply spiritual culture, they knew that there was a deeper energy and deeper life than them as a human body.
This concludes part one of my conversation with senior Aboriginal social worker Josephine Lee. I hope you've enjoyed this episode so far. Tune in next week as we continue to explore Jo's amazing life and how she has transformed her early life experience into a learning action framework for making good in the world. Thanks for listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities. You'll find all the show notes from today's podcast at www.metaphorically-speaking.com.au. I'm on the lookout for inspiring interviewees. So if you or someone you know is walking the talk in their work or community, then I'd love to hear from you. You can drop me an email at lucy@metaphorically-speaking.com.au or visit my contact page on the Metaphorically Speaking website. Until next time, just keep on walking.